I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. After a stinging rebuke from United Nations officials who called the world's response to the disaster in the Indian Ocean stingy, President Bush spoke from his ranch in Crawford, Texas today, saying, "We will stand with victims as they start to rebuild their communities." Australia's Foreign Minister, Alexander Downer, also said today that the U.S., Japan, and Australia are considering a coalition of aid. Well, while nations unite, aid agencies say help from individuals is imperative to fill the gap until funds are released. But before that check is signed, what should individual donors take into account? Joining us on the line from his office in Arlington, Virginia, is Bennett Weiner. He's Chief Operating Officer at the Better Business Bureau's Wise Giving Alliance. And Bennett, welcome.
Thank you.
And I know that you have a website that people can click onto as we talk about this. It is?
Yes, it's give.org, G-I-V-E dot org.
Right. And on there, you can click on the icon and find out what to do after natural disasters. What's your first caution to people?
Well, first thing I'd say, watch out for excessive pressure to make an on-the-spot gift decision. I know that there's the emotion of the moment because of this horrific tragedy. And for others, there may be a motivation to give before the tax year closes in order to get a deduction. But don't let your guard down. Give responsibly. And there are a number of things that one could do to find out more about the organization to make sure that your donation is going to be used effectively.
Well, a lot of people look at certain ratios, you know, what percentage of my dollar actually goes to relief. But we're also cautioned that that may not be the best equation because it does take money to raise money. And so some organizations that are quite reputable might actually have to spend some of your dollar on raising money.
Well, all organizations are going to have some administrative and fundraising expenses in carrying out that work. That just goes routinely with all organizations, whether they're involved in relief or other areas. One of the keys, though, is to find out more about their actual programs and activities as well. Are they experienced in carrying out relief efforts? Do they already have operations prior to this tragedy in the areas that are affected by the tsunami? If the organization has had no experience in relief work and is a startup or some other type of new organization, there may be some problems in their being able to deliver aid quickly to those in need, even if they are well-intentioned.
Well, in fact, we've been speaking on the program with local members of the Sri Lankan Association. That's the Sri Lankan Association of New England. They've got quite an effort going and a lot of people responding. And if you go to their website, you see that they are going to give the cash directly to Oxfam in Sri Lanka, Oxfam being a very reputable organization. Would that be the kind of link that you might want to know about?
Well, yes. I mean, if the organization is collecting funds and then passing it along to some other organization, certainly it's easier and faster to give directly to whatever charity is carrying out the actual relief work. The key is that the organizations that are carrying out the activities are the ones probably that you want to find and select, so your donation can get as fast as possible to those in need.
I know there are other websites. GuideStar.org is one. But how does your website determine which is a good organization?
The Give.org website, in part, provides access to reports on national charities that are evaluated in relation to a set of 20 accountability standards, which look into issues beyond the law in terms of the organization's governance, fundraising practices, finances, donor privacy, and other issues, and we'll share that information with the public so you can be assured that the organization is being transparent and accountable to the resources it's collected. In terms of trying to find out about which relief organizations already have activities that are assisting the tsunami victims, I would suggest going to the website of interaction.org. They are a membership organization of various relief charities located in Washington, D.C., and they have a listing up on their site of their entities that are already involved in various relief efforts in that part of the world.
Interaction.org. We'll have all this information on our website, by the way, for listeners who are following along. Is it recommended that people go through at least American-based organizations and not through organizations in the foreign countries?
Well, if you want to make sure that your contribution is going to be deductible, you really have to give to an entity that has a U.S.-based operation in terms of an office in the United States that is collecting funds and has received charitable tax-exempt status from the IRS. If the entity that you're contributing to is foreign-based, located in another country, and if that's where your donation is going to, first, you may not be able to get any type of deduction for tax purposes. And secondly, it's going to be a little bit more difficult in checking out that particular organization to make sure you know what they're doing. So there are two cautions, really, that you have to be careful about. One, giving directly to a foreign-located charity.
It seems like a crass consideration at this point, but if it encourages people to give more money, you know, a tax deduction, then it's worthy of consideration. Ben, any final thoughts?
One thing I would caution people about is to watch out for phone appeals or Internet appeals that are asking for an immediate gift and asking or seeking out credit card numbers or other personal financial information. Mm. It's an unfortunate fact that there are con artists at this time that will seek to take advantage of the emotion of the moment and American generosity to get you to give without thinking or looking any further. Mm. The other thing about checking to see if the organization has a U.S.-based operation that is tax-exempt. Organizations that solicit in the United States also have to register appropriately with about 40 different states across the country, and there are a number of regulations and things they need to meet in order to be soliciting appropriately in the United States. There is an additional level of check that you'll have in being assured that your contribution is going to be used appropriately.
Tracking your money. Bennett, thank you.
Thank you.
Bennett Weiner, Chief Operating Officer for the Better Business Bureau's Wise Giving Alliance at www.give.org. Other websites to research charities, GuideStar.org and Interaction.org, which lists more than 30 member organizations that are funneling money to tsunami relief. Among those they suggest, Catholic Relief Services, Save the Children, and CARE International. And now a decided change of pace and a look back. Baseball had moments of joy and disappointment this year. The Boston Red Sox winning their first championship in 86 years. We might have mentioned that once or twice. But baseball also had a steroid scandal. Basketball got a black eye and hockey is taking a long time out. Here to talk about some of the big sports stories of 2004, Dave Kindred, columnist for the Sporting News. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Robin.
And Helene Elliott, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Helene.
How are you doing?
And okay, we're from Boston. We're fine because our Red Sox won. Joy for us, maybe not so much for St. Louis or the Yankees. But I'm wondering, out on the West Coast, did Los Angeles, for instance, even care that the Red Sox won?
Oh, absolutely, because I think two-thirds of the people here are transplanted Easterners, and I'm guilty of that myself. So the Red Sox were a huge story, and it's funny, too, but during the World Series and the playoffs, I was in Canada for part of it, and even the TV ratings in Eastern Canada were skyrocketing. I think the Red Sox were kind of a universal story that everybody loved.
Dave Kindred, I think you'd agree, but that Red Sox win was overshadowed by the steroid scandal in baseball, not tainting any of the Red Sox at least yet, but this investigation into the Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative, or BALCO, revealed that both the lab and a personal trainer were giving steroids to some pretty big names in baseball. Big story, right?
Certainly, it's a huge story. You know, if the Red Sox are the feel-good story of the baseball season, certainly the BALCO implications are the feel-bad part of baseball. Jason Giambi with the Yankees admitted to the grand jury that he had used steroids. Barry Bonds admitted that he had been given steroids, although he said that he didn't know what he was taking orally. No one believes that. So I think that certainly baseball has been stained by those accusations, and I think it's going to be a while before we really get to the bottom of that.
And Dave, we've talked before on this program about, you know, what impact that story should have. Are there going to be asterisks? Are records going to be changed? What do you think as we go into 2005?
I'm not in favor of any kind of asterisks or marks. I just depend on the intelligence of the baseball fans. No one put an asterisk next to Babe Ruth's name in 1927 when he hit 60 home runs, although he was hitting a different baseball than players had hit 10 years before. Real baseball fans understand the difference in eras. The 1930s were another offensive era. the 1990s may go down as a steroid era. We'll just let people figure that out for themselves.
Right. And Helene, there was another, you know, doping charge, the Olympics.
You know, I think a lot of us got into sports writing because we liked the story of human drama and competition, and instead we find ourselves studying pharmaceutical handbooks and legal handbooks now because it's just popping up everywhere. When you see Kelly White, was a world champion, not competing in the Olympics and relinquishing her titles and admitting she used banned substances. And you see Marion Jones with this cloud of suspicion hanging over her as well.
You mentioned Kelly White. She's a sprinter, but runner Marion Jones is really fighting these charges that she did any doping. In fact, she's suing the person who claims that she took steroids.
She's suing Victor Conti, who has claimed that he saw her inject herself with human growth hormone. The whole sport has to get past this, and I don't know how it can, because it seems every time the pharmacists and the scientists come up with improved testing, the athletes come up with ways to beat those tests.
And remind us, Dave, on that note, where does Olympic gold medalist and Massachusetts native Tyler Hamilton stand on this? He did test positive for illegal blood transfusions, but he was cleared in some cases. Where does his story stand?
No, Robin, he was not cleared. He was found positive in both the Olympics and then in a major event, I think, in Spain 2 weeks later. But the Olympic event, the test was flawed in that the second sample was somehow frozen and thereby could not be used. So he was allowed to keep the gold medal from the Olympics, but he tested positive again 2 weeks later, and both those tests returned positive. Mm-hmm. Cycling has gone through this kind of thing for forever. And one of the major surprises in cycling is that Lance Armstrong's name has never come up in anything more than an accusation.
In fact, Lance Armstrong, 6th straight Tour de France win this past year, and an amazing story about his efforts to raise monies for cancer research.
Well, those bracelets that they're selling, apparently they've sold millions of those. You see them everywhere, and that's a good thing. I'm all in favor of that.
And Elaine, just staying with the Olympics for a few more seconds, the American gymnast Paul Hamm barely hangs on to his gold medal. That was also a pretty gripping story.
I think it was almost a horrifying story in the sense that the president of the International Gymnastics Federation sent Paul a letter saying that, you know, well, we screwed up, so you should give up your gold medal. And to me, that's absurd. If it's the fault of the judges, and there certainly was a fault in terms of they had the wrong scoring value for an element that the Korean gymnast did, I don't see why Paul Hamm has to be the one who gives up the medal. International federations and lawyers and things like that exist for reasons like that, to make sure that the rules are enforced. If the mistake was not caught by the Korean delegation at that time, according to the rules, then that's just unfortunate for all involved.
Boy, Dave and Helene, I'm reminded that you guys had your work cut out for you this past year, and we haven't even gotten to, you know, the basket brawl or hockey lockout. So I tell you what, Helene Elliott, sports reporter for the Los Angeles Times, Dave Kindred, sports columnist for the Sporting News, you stay right there. And just ahead, we're going to talk more about the big sports stories of 2004. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our look at big sports stories of 2004 with Helene Elliott, sports reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hi again, Helene.
Hello.
We also have Dave Kindred, sports columnist for the Sporting News. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Robin.
And we've talked already about the steroid scandal in baseball, the Red Sox first World Series win in 86 years, but there were so many other stories. Helene, NHL hockey, 4 months of an owner's lockout of the players. What's the problem again? Remind us.
The owners say they're losing money. The players' union says, oh, we don't believe those figures because you're doing some creative accounting, so how can we trust you? And it's a very ugly situation. I think that the NHL is endangering its future. People tend to have very short memories, and if you learn that you can get along without hockey and you can spend your time doing other things and spend your money in other ways, people are going to get out of the habit of going to hockey games.
Mm-hmm. Dave, I was thinking here in Boston at the big Fleet Center, they actually opened up the Fleet Center at one point so that people could come skate on the Boston Bruins ice, kind of keeping them close to the game that way. But isn't that true? I mean, except for diehard fans, are many people sort of saying, oh, yeah, is there a sport missing?
Well, I think probably so. I'm not a hockey person. You know, while I write about all sports, hockey is the least of it. And I think that's probably true of many Americans, most Americans, in fact. I think they're passionate hockey fans, and almost all of them are in the building when their team plays. So it's very easy, as Helene says, for this season to go by without people even missing it. And now there's even talk I read in the Sporting News this week, Cara Yario talking about next season already being in danger because this is such an insoluble problem. And this is after the players have already offered to give back 25% of their money. So it's a huge problem.
Right. Well, moving to pro basketball, which had a certain ugliness of its own this past year, the November 19th basket brawl at the Pistons-Pacers game, which resulted in the season-long suspension of Indiana Pacer Ron Artest. Helene, what's been the fallout from this? I mean, the two teams met recently, and, you know, it was a love fest.
Well, I think they did a very smart PR move in terms of when they met again recently on Christmas Day. They brought out Christmas presents for needy kids and, you know, in the spirit of the season and all that. But the one thing that if you haven't been to an NBA game that most people don't realize is how close the fans are to the benches and to the players. And honestly, I'm surprised that nothing like this happened before. You know, fans are always yelling horrible, horrible things at visiting teams and at players, and someday somebody's just going to take it into his head to go out there and punch somebody or heaven forbid, stab somebody. And then we'll all see a lot of changes in terms of security and the way American sports are perceived.
David, and that reminds me, is this year a part of, you know, like a long trend of sports being less and less for kids?
Well, you have to be careful where you take your kids, I think, in anything. And certainly you don't want them to be four rows away from Ron Artest at any time for any reason. And the steroid thing, I just did a column last week for the Sporting News about a high school kid who started on steroids when he was 17 and winds up killing himself. There's no good example in that, and you would hope that at some point these players realize that whether they want to be role models or not, they are, and they need to comport themselves that way.
Well, speaking of which, Helene, you have a basketball drama out your way in Los Angeles. Christmas Day also saw the first meeting of the Lakers with Kobe Bryant, who was charged with rape last year. That case was dropped. And the Miami Heat, which now features former Lakers star Shaquille O'Neal. Some say it was Kobe Bryant who said that Shaq had to go. I can't work with this guy. So how big is a drama is that for Lakers fans?
Oh, it's just been bigger than any soap opera you could possibly imagine. It was just incredible. I mean, all the local TV stations, even the national ones as well, were doing these countdowns, you know, 5 days to Kobe versus Shaq, 4 days to Kobe versus Shaq. And it was just hysterical. It was just crazy. But you know what? The TV ratings were astronomical, so people must have been watching it.
Yeah. Well, Dave Kindred, this week also saw Indianapolis Colts Peyton Manning break Dan Marino's record for most touchdowns in a single season. Marino had held that record for 20 years. How healthy is football?
Well, football is the healthiest sport of all, and it always will be because it appeals to a certain violent instinct in Americans. And the NFL does the greatest marketing job of any industry in the universe, probably. Manning's season was fabulous. You know, he's a fabulous character, too. I mean, he wound up breaking the record on a touchdown pass in the last minute that left them 2 points from tying the game. His first thought is not to celebrate. His first thought is to raise two fingers and say, we need 2 points now to tie this game. It was a perfect way for a great player to set a great record.
But then again, might he end up being, like Dan Marino, a record holder, but one without a Super Bowl ring?
Well, there's a lot of those people going around, and this could be his year. I hope so. You know, Tom Brady has shown that you can take a team there, you know, on your own virtuosity. I think Manning can do that.
Tom Brady, of course, the quarterback of the New England Patriots.
I've heard of that.
We're bragging quite a bit here in New England, Helene. But could you also take a look ahead to 2005? What do you see in the future for sports, Helene?
That's a very good question. I wonder if we'll see more intense security efforts at baseball games and basketball games and in the wake of the Pistons-Pacers incident. And, of course, baseball's had some black marks in that area as well. I think we'll probably – it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Washington baseball team, if that ever comes to pass, as it appears it now will, and will fans welcome baseball back in Washington? I mean, there were teams in Washington, and they failed because the fans didn't support them well enough, and I'm curious to see how that unfolds.
Yeah. And, Dave, our Connecticut fans want us to mention University of Connecticut men's and women's basketball teams this past year won Division I titles each. Do you see a repeat for them in 2005 or any other prediction for 2005?
I have no idea what's going to happen with UConn. All I know is that they're always good and they always will be good. There's no telling what's going to happen. That's the fun of college basketball.
Yeah. Anything else you want to hazard out on a limb on?
Not me.
I'll hazard a guess that there will be more poker shows on TV.
Yeah, poker emerging as, you know, the sport of choice, especially for college students.
Who knew? Who knew? Really?
Helene Elliott of the Los Angeles Times, Dave Kindred of the Sporting News, thank you so much, and a Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, a Syrian intellectual who's been called the Martin Luther of Islam is calling for a Protestant-like reformation for Muslims. Also, rumor on the internet is that the EPA is paying poor people to test toxins. We'll find out what's true. That's tomorrow. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Observatories around the world detected the massive weekend earthquake off the Indonesian island of Sumatra. Officials at the Weston Observatory in Weston, Massachusetts, say they recorded the vibrations and aftershocks for several hours after Sunday's quake, which spawned that deadly South Asian tsunami. Well, the observatory's director is Boston College geophysics professor Dr. John Ebel. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes earlier today.
Dr. Ebel, before we talk about what you recorded here in Massachusetts from the quake, can we first get your impressions about the magnitude?
Well, as a magnitude 9 earthquake, this is a truly profound earthquake that shifts major amounts of rock in the earth. A fault probably about 600 miles long, shifted rock on the average maybe 40, 50 feet or even more on either side of the fault. That's a major, major shift and something we've seen only a few times over the past century plus of earthquake observations.
I understand it that this quake was so powerful that in a very minor way, it's affected the Earth's rotation.
Well, that's right. What happened was you shifted so much rock in this earthquake that it slightly changed the shape of the Earth. And any time the shape of the Earth changes, it changes the direction of the north rotation pole. So if you were standing on the north pole before the earthquake, you actually would not be standing on it after the earthquake. And those shifts also can either speed up or slow down the planet.
Based on all of this, what did your instruments read at the observatory in Weston?
Well, anytime you have a large earthquake, in fact, any earthquake larger than about magnitude 6, vibrations from that earthquake can be detected by seismographic stations all throughout the world. In this particular earthquake, because it was so large and the seismic waves were so large, we saw waves that were probably of the order of a few inches in amplitude move through the New England region after the earthquake, and the earth was literally ringing like a bell for hours and hours and hours. It took our seismographs about 8 or 10 hours to settle back to the point where we could see the background noise again, and even then we were seeing some of the largest aftershocks from the Sumatra region.
Geologically speaking, what's the chance of a major earthquake like that occurring off the Massachusetts or the New England coast?
Well, in Sumatra, you have the Indian Ocean plate pushing under the Burma plate or the Southeast Asia plate to the east. So the Indian Ocean floor is actually sliding back into the earth. Off the east coast of the United States here, for example, the Atlantic Ocean floor is firmly attached to the North American plate. It's not pushing back under North America. And it's only where you have the ocean floor pushing back into the earth that you have these truly profound earthquakes. So I would not expect to see a magnitude 9 earthquake occur off the east coast of the United States. Magnitude 7, which is a damaging, very damaging earthquake in itself, yes, we've seen that historically in the past, but not in magnitude 9.
There's been quite a lot of discussion about tsunamis in the last couple of days and the fact that in the last 100 years, there have been tsunamis along the west coast of the United States and up in Alaska. In history, have we ever had one on the east coast? Have we ever had one wash ashore in New England?
Well, along the east coast of the U.S., the threat of tsunamis comes from two potential sources. The Caribbean region has subduction, where the North Atlantic Ocean is sliding back under the what we call the Caribbean plate. And there have been a number of tsunamis in the Caribbean from large earthquakes there up to magnitude 8. The other threat was evidenced by an earthquake in 1929 off the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. And that was a thrusting earthquake associated with a submarine landslide, and that sent a tsunami along the Newfoundland coast. And so if we had an earthquake like that, perhaps triggering a submarine landslide, then it would be possible to send a tsunami on shore along the east coast. It turns out I already have had a student for the last year or so looking for possible tsunami deposits along the coast of Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And so this is something that we've been actually concerned about already.
Doctor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Boston College geophysics professor Dr. John Ebel is director of the Weston Observatory in Massachusetts. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. It's time to air some of your thoughts. After last week's bombing at the U.S. military base in Mosul in Iraq, we spoke with Bill Nemitz, editor of the Maine Portland Press-Herald, who was at the scene with a Maine National Guard unit. Donald Devaney, a career military man who served in Vietnam in the 60s, wrote from his home in Honolulu, "In 1968, there was a popular film, The Dirty Dozen, making the rounds in Vietnam. The plot of the movie had to do with stealing an ambulance during a war game and capturing the command post. A week after we saw that movie, the Viet Cong stole an ambulance, entered an airfield, blew up 22 aircraft, and escaped, pretending to be evacuating the wounded." Well, Bill Nemitz wrote a story in the Portland Press-Herald about a medic from Maine who, as part of a training paper, imagined an attack on that mess tent in Mosul. I'm wondering if that fell into the wrong hands and fiction became tragic reality. Well, we also spoke last week with Ben Witherington of the Asbury Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky. Witherington said that while the biblical story of the birth of Christ has been embellished over the centuries, he believes it's basically true. The Reverend John Baumgartner of Grand Ledge, Michigan writes, "Asbury Seminary is considered conservative. John Spong and many other scholars would say the stories in Matthew and Luke are completely fictitious and added in the 9th decade to support a developing tradition of Jesus' divinity. As such, they are wonderful stories expressing a truth regarding God, but they should not be taken literally." Well, Edward Valpy of Guilford, New Hampshire, didn't think the discussion should have taken place at all. He writes, "You cited a claim that the story of the Immaculate Conception might have been a cover for an embarrassing out-of-wedlock pregnancy. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in Immaculate Conceptions. Nevertheless, I found this segment aired during this season to be in poor taste." Well, many of you appreciated our story on the growing problem of caring for elderly parents, but Robert Wolf wanted to share an option. He lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. His very independent 97-year-old father lives in Tucson, Arizona. Robert writes, "With the help of the National Association of Professional Geriatric Care Managers, my sister and I found an excellent care manager in the city in which Dad lived, who met with our father for about an hour a week. By the time Dad's condition changed, the care manager had already established a trusting relationship with him and was able to get him to accept the series of changes in his living arrangements that he needed. We didn't have to be the heavy when that time came. Well, as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Many of the survivors of Sunday's tsunami are communicating through emails. Rick Von Felt, an American living in Singapore but vacationing in Thailand, witnessed the disaster from his hotel on the island of Phuket. He wrote emails to friends and family, who shared some with us. Here's a sampling, read by Here and Now's Sean Cole.
I arrived in Phuket, an island off the west coast of Thailand, on December 26. The last time I stayed here, I stayed on Kata Beach, and I nearly stayed there again. But this time I wanted to be closer to the larger beach, Patong. I took a taxi to Patong Beach. As we drove along the beach, I looked to my right and noticed that all the people were standing looking out to sea. What were they looking at? Then I saw that there was, well, no water. I thought it was odd and wondered, was the tide pool that strong last time I was here? We arrived at the hotel, and I noticed that all of the staff was crowding on the edge, looking over the bay. Suddenly, in front of our eyes, the bay began to fill rapidly, as if someone had turned on giant faucets. It just seemed to rush in. In about 10 to 15 minutes, the entire bay filled in. And then we saw the swell. It came rushing over the wall, and it kept rising, higher than the palm trees along the edge of the beach. We all stood there, stunned. People came running up the road, shrieking, "Water! The water!" We stood there in disbelief, but it wasn't over. It just kept coming and coming. It would recede and then come again. The 18-foot wall of water rushing over the seawall, covering the beach, the shops, and everything in its path. Down below, we could see boats and cars and everything smaller being thrashed again and again against buildings. It looked like a bathtub with lots of small toys. Up the hill came bloodied and battered people. As the waves would recede for 10 to 15 minutes, people would try to make a run for it. Most made it, but some got caught. We sat and watched in horror as the waves rushed back, grabbing people's feet and throwing them up in the air like little rubber ducks. For 4 hours this kept up. The sound of people screaming and crying won't leave my ears for quite a while. Our hotel became a refugee camp. Wet people, in shock, bloody, with broken arms and legs. People cried and cried. Instead of watching what was happening below, they turned and looked away, not wanting to relive over and over what they'd just been through. That night, people were camped out everywhere, but when I woke up the next morning, they were all gone. Government convoys had come in the night and taken them further inland. Meanwhile, the place I almost stayed at in Kata was destroyed. I'm writing now from an internet cafe. On the way here this morning, I was standing with others outside a basement supermarket as the rescue teams began to drain it of water. About every 15 to 20 minutes, they would pull another body out. I suspect I will have nightmares of this for a while. Last night, I came across a man and his two little boys. Along with their mom, they were on the beach when it hit. Now they can't find the mom. And the stories go on, but I am exhausted from telling them.
Our colleague Sean Cole reading some of Rick Von Feld's emails. Rick is an American who lives in Singapore but was vacationing in Phuket, Thailand when the tsunami hit. And he's continued to write about how he lived by candlelight in his hotel room, bathed in the pool, dodged downed power lines, and was stunned to find tourists at an inland hotel acting as if nothing had happened. Waiting in the airport for his flight out, he grew angry when he heard reports of the size of the earthquake. "Why didn't we know that in Phuket?" he writes. Yesterday, at home in Singapore, he stood in his first shower in 4 days. He writes, "It felt great. Then I started to think about how valuable that water will be to millions of people in the next 72 hours. In Phuket, the government was driving around dropping off cases of water on street corners, but in other places, people won't be so lucky. People will start drinking anything. I turned the water off." Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Before Muddy Waters, way before Eric Clapton and the Rolling Stones, there was Robert Johnson.
And I feel so lonesome. You hear me when I'm on.
That's Robert Johnson's Terraplane Blues from 1936. But the blues man's legend first blossomed in Great Britain in the 60s, with devilish tales of drinking and hard times. But what was fact and what was fiction? Music journalist Elijah Wald writes about the man, the myth, and the music in the book Escaping the Delta, Robert Johnson and the Invention of the Blues, which is now out in paperback. Elijah begins by writing, "There's probably been more romantic foolishness written about blues and Robert Johnson in particular than about any other genre or performer in the 20th century."
I guess I'm saying he should be a slightly different legend. I mean, as long as we talk about Robert Johnson as the roots of the Rolling Stones and Eric Clapton, that's completely true. Mm-hmm. They fell in love with his work and he was very influential on them. But people often talk about Robert Johnson as the most important or the most influential blues artist of the 1930s, and that's just ridiculous. Yeah. He was almost unknown in the 1930s, and if we want to talk about black American music, he had almost no effect on black music. His effect really starts with the rock and rollers discovering him in the 60s.
You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining her door.
Come On in My Kitchen by Robert Johnson, recorded in 1936. Well, now, Elijah, who influenced Robert Johnson?
Well, there's a list of people, and I actually put out a CD to go with the book. It's called Back to the Crossroads, The Roots of Robert Johnson. But the thing about Robert Johnson is he's the first important blues artist who learned more off records than from the people around him. He's really a creation of the pop world of his day. Mm. So he was learning from the big stars, people like Leroy Carr, Petey Wheatstraw, Kokomo Arnold, Tampa Red.
And in fact, let's listen to a little of one of those artists. You mentioned the CD. It's called Back to the Crossroads, The Roots of Robert Johnson. Some of the songs that influenced him, some that he, as you said, imitated off other records. Let's listen to two. First, the song Little Queen of Spades by Robert Johnson.
Now she is a little queen of spades, and the men will not let her be.
All right, now let's listen to King of Spades by Petey Wheatstraw, also known as the Devil's Son-in-Law. And what are we listening for here?
Well, there are two things. Johnson's song was a strict answer song to this, but also Petey Wheatstraw had a mannerism. He had this thing, whoo, well, well, that he does on every single record he made and that Robert Johnson imitates perfectly.
So it's sort of a call and response between the two songs?
If we want to talk folklore, it's call and response, but if we want to talk pop culture, he heard a hit and he wrote an answer song to it.
Yeah. Let's listen to Petey Wheatstraw.
I am the king of spades, and the women takes on over me. I know when I lay my racket, woo, my bell, I'm sweet as I can be.
Let's compare them again. Petey Wheatstraw.
Would I been work for you, little mama? Woo, my pal, baby, if you ain't got a dime.
And Robert Johnson.
Well, a man don't need a woman. Who fair brown that he got to give all his money to.
By the way, was Robert Johnson imitating Petey Wheatstraw in more ways than one? I mentioned Petey was known as the devil's son-in-law. Let's just mention the devil for a moment here, because Robert Johnson was supposed to have sold his soul to the devil.
Yeah, well, that's really a myth that started in the 1960s. And again, it's a white myth. If you ask people, there's a wonderful interview with one of Robert Johnson's school friends where a guy says, so did he ever talk about selling his soul to the devil? The guy says, oh, yeah, he was always joking around like that. We never did take him serious. You know, he was a Petey Wheatstraw nut and that sort of stuff, just like now. You know, being a gangster, being a dangerous character.
But why was it? I mean, again, it goes back to how the white fans who embraced him in the 60s and 70s and beyond sort of created a new mythological character in Robert Johnson. Why was it? Why was that so important to people like Eric Clapton and the Rolling Stones?
Well, you know, everybody has their dreams. And the black dream when Johnson was growing up, and they put it on Robert Johnson, was, you know, you learn some of the, you learn to be a great guitarist, you learn to sound like the big stars in Chicago, and you can wear a suit and drive a Cadillac and move the hell out of the Delta. Mm. Whereas the myth in 1960s was the danger of rock and roll, James Dean, Marlon Brando, die young, leave a good-looking corpse. Mm. So, you know, each group had its myth, and both groups put that myth on Robert Johnson.
Right. How did he die?
The story, there are various stories, but the most likely one is that he was poisoned by a jealous husband. A guy who he was working for put some poison in his whiskey.
And, you know, is there a chance that he just had some bad fish? I mean, you know, going along with the...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's, you know, he certainly fooled around with a lot of women, but we know very little about... I mean, his death certificate said syphilis. I see no reason to think there was any evidence for that except a plantation manager saying, oh, he's a musician. He probably just died of syphilis.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to tell, it's hard to tell. When all your love's in vain, all my love's in vain.
So, Elijah, what are you saying? Were blues artists way back in the day, you know, really happy-go-lucky guys, and for some reason white musicians, modern white musicians, have wanted to keep them in a certain stereotype?
It wasn't so much happy-go-lucky or not. It was that they were pop musicians. You know, first of all, Bessie Smith, Ma Rainey, then people like Leroy Carr, Tampa Red. But Robert Johnson also in his dreams, in his aspirations, were people who were, they were hip, current musicians, they were following the latest trends, they were following the latest hits, and they were in the most popular style of their day. And it, we've reinvented them as sort of these monsters from the mythical Delta, and they just weren't that.
Right. If they lived today, if they were producing their music today, they might want to use a synthesizer or sample music or do anything they could to be more contemporary.
Personally, I think there's very little question that if someone like Robert Johnson were around today, he'd be doing rap. It's just the obvious thing. For someone with his, you know, someone with the taste of trying to be sort of a dangerous hip musician, black musician, you're doing rap now.
Yeah.
From Memphis to Norfolk, it's a 36-hour drive. A minute lack of prisoner, and he's never satisfied.
It's funny, it's almost another form of subjugation. That the white artist wants to keep the mythical black artist in this sort of organic, on the porch, in the rocker form in their mind's eye.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. Someone like Robert Johnson, all, you know, already in his day, all we have recorded is him doing blues, but he sang Gene Autry hits, he sang Bing Crosby, he sang all the pop music of his time.
He loved them.
Well, he was a pop musician.
Yeah.
I went to the club.
Elijah, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elijah Wald's book, Escaping the Delta, Robert Johnson and the Invention of the Blues, is now out in paperback. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now. for a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.